But in June 1988, there was a close call. Lenny got a telephone call one day from a particularly overwrought Kevin. "Get a copy of today's LA Times," he cried. When Lenny looked at the newspaper, he couldn't believe it. JPL computer penetrated by a hacker was the front page headline. The duo's traversing of the internet had taken them briefly into a computer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena a few months earlier. Kevin was interested in the JPL computer because it was one of the few VMS machines on the internet, and he had considered using it as a storage locker for the VMS source code, but then decided against it. But they didn't think they had been detected. Luckily, the laboratory appeared to suspect Chaos Club because of evidence of the club's trademark Insidious Trojan Horse, the login-out patch. The newspaper article said that, although no classified material was compromised by the hackers, one JPL engineer said officials there worried that an intruder could learn how to send bogus commands to the 8 unmanned Interplanetary Explorer spacecraft the laboratory controlled. Kevin and Lenny, of course, had no such intentions. They had just been poking around. By early fall of 1988, Kevin was acting particularly paranoid, eating more than usual and making unreasonable demands upon Lenny. He had no regular job, leaving him with plenty of time to be obsessed with his hacking projects. He insisted that Lenny be ready to drop what he was doing in his legitimate job and start work for Kevin promptly at 3 o'clock every afternoon. Or he would call Lenny at 5 in the morning and instruct him to go to VPA to insert the chaos patch just as everyone in Massachusetts and New Hampshire was logging on. Kevin had changed his telephone billing name to James Bond. The last 3 digits of his new number were 007. He had changed Lenny's billing name, too, to Oliver North. Kevin made it clear to Lenny that he wanted to stay several steps ahead of the growing pack of hounds Digital had deployed for the chase. By this time, Kevin had improved his phone work so much that he made it almost impossible for USC to track him down. His most effective red herring was his use of the call forwarding feature on the telephone company's computers. This masking technique meant that when the phone company initiated a trace, it would lead to a blind alley. Kevin was ruthlessly arbitrary in forwarding the telephone numbers, and until he and Lenny read Chuck Bushy's mail one day, they had no idea that Digital had gone so far as to trace the calls back to the random numbers they had chosen to forward to. One of these random numbers led back to the apartment of a Middle Eastern immigrant in Santa Monica, a middle-aged man who was watching television when federal agents barged in looking for computer equipment. They found none. When in the throes of hacking, Lenny was having a good time. The idea of having control over many computers was incredibly seductive. The challenge of figuring out where to go to look for the information they wanted was more stimulating than any college programming course. And all the while, they watched a $12 billion company flounder helplessly as it headed down one cul-de-sac after another. Yet something in Kevin was changing. He had become so secretive that when he told Lenny he had lost the Security Pacific job, the greater surprise to Lenny was that he had gotten it in the first place. The same thing had happened when Kevin got and quickly lost the job at GTE. For Lenny, too, the thrill was beginning to disappear. He became suspicious that Kevin was storing information to use against him someday while withholding anything about himself that Lenny could use. They began to argue frequently over trifling things, and they were constantly betting against each other. Twice, Lenny lost a $120 bet on whether Kevin could break into the VPA computer from outside. Kevin did it through sheer doggedness. When it came to perseverance, Lenny was a distant second. He lost most of the bets. And since Kevin had come back from his months underground a few years earlier, he seemed to take his electronic penetration more seriously than ever. Perhaps he was thinking that if he was going to lie to Bonnie every night about where he was, it should be for a reason he considered defensible. He had goals to meet. On the other hand, something seemed to be beyond his control. He kept telling Lenny that he wanted to stop the break-ins as soon as they finished the project they were working on, but once they had finished one project, Kevin always seemed to want to start another. By November, Kevin was insisting on coming to VPA every night to break into Digital. Whenever Lenny tried to beg off so that he could get some sleep, see other friends, or spend time with his girlfriend, Kevin would badger him until he agreed to spend the evening with him. Sometimes he even called Lenny at 2 a.m. and roused him from bed, insisting that he meet him at VPA. Kevin was obsessed, and he had drawn Lenny into his mania. Bonnie, who was paying most of the bills, had started losing patience with her errant husband. She paged him constantly, and Lenny sat in disgust as he listened to Kevin lie. "I'm at the UCLA Law Library working on the Pierce case," he would tell her, or, "I'm studying for my extension class." After he hung up, Kevin would grumble about Bonnie. She was a nuisance, getting in the way. He was thinking of divorcing her. Lenny could feel that things were heating up. He turned to Roscoe. Kevin was getting out of hand, he told him. He felt as if he couldn't pee without checking with Kevin first. Roscoe, too, was beginning to get fed up with this roller coaster relationship between Lenny and Kevin. It was true that Kevin was a nuisance. He was calling Roscoe all the time, too. Mostly, Roscoe felt terrible for Bonnie, who knew of none of it. He resisted a temptation to tell her to go to the UCLA Law Library one night and look for her husband. Now, Lenny was sounding panicked. Roscoe didn't want to get involved, but he did offer him some advice. Get a lawyer. Even now that the VMS software was encrypted and safely locked away in a storage locker, Kevin still wouldn't quit. His next project, he decided, was to steal a game called Doom from Digital Star Cluster. He was quite content with the setup at VPA. Judging from the unsuccessful traces, there was no one even close to catching them. In the face of Lenny's protests, Kevin was insistent. What had once been a friendship between like-minded teenagers had become a series of demands and contests and long nights in the stuffy offices at VPA. If this was a big-time electronic crime, then Lenny wanted nothing more to do with it.